You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And as always, this time of year, we're thrilled to be joined by friend of the pod, third Pelton brother extraordinaire, Ben Baldwin, to preview the 2025 Seattle Seahawks and NFL season. Ben, you've been on vacation mode for a long period of time. You ready to get back into football?
I am so ready, and I was just thinking about this. This is the most excited I've been for a Seahawks opening game without any reason whatsoever. Like, there's no good reason to be excited for this season, probably.
I'm kind of fascinated by this. I'm
I
happy that
so
you're excited.
Looking forward to
somebody is
seeing a Seahawks game. And I think a lot of it is they're going to look so different. They have a new offensive coordinator, new quarterback. DK Metcalf is gone, and they have the chance to build on what was a really great defense in the second part of last season. So we're going to get into this, I'm sure, when we talk about the over-unders. Expectations aren't that high, but there's just so many reasons I'm curious to see what it looks like on the field. And it's against a 49ers team that I think is also fascinating, coming off last season where they had so many injuries, starting the season week one against a division rival. I've really talked myself into this, so I'm really excited.
We have pivoted to positivity.
Yeah, football's back. How, at least for 1 week, the novelty factor of football being back is definitely what's winning out in my heart right now.
It made me think your monologue about it was week one. It was the Seahawks season opener in Indianapolis, where we had the
yes.
famous concourse meeting.
This is like
the Shane Waldron
the most notable week one that has ever happened.
Yeah. Mythical week one halftime.
Well, I was also thinking back to being at the Seahawks-Lions game, which was not that long ago. That was 2 years ago, the Seahawks-Lions.
I hate to interrupt you. This is the first ever time I have seen Dan Wilson get angry at a baseball game.
Oh, wow.
He is out and talking. I looked. Did you see my face when they made the call? Dan is out. There's a chance of him getting thrown out of this game.
He's talking
sternly?
He got
ejected.
Oh,
Dan
wow.
Got tossed. That's his first ejection, right?
You asked for it.
Oh my God! I'm calling it right now. This might be the moment the Mariners wake up.
Okay.
Sorry to do this on a Seahawks podcast, but oh, Lou Piniella's in the stands too. Wow, with his son who looks like a clone of Lou Piniella. You've got to earn it, Dan. Dan, get your money's worth. Don't just walk off. Anyway,
if there has ever been a better sign that we have pivoted to a Mariners podcast, it is just an interrupting the Seahawks
has needed to happen for how many games are we in? Like 130 games into the season? This has needed to happen for 130 games.
Even in game one?
It needed to happen back in game September of last year. So
it's game 139.
Kind of fired up. Right. The Mariners are down 2-0 right now in the top of the third. I bet they win this game.
Okay, well, we'll revisit that on the weekly
And I bet
pod.
The Seahawks beat the Niners.
There we go. Wow.
I actually do think so, but we'll get to that later this week when we do our percentage chances of victory.
I mean, maybe we'll get to an over-under is the conclusion of this pod.
Okay, so Ben, you're excited. Is it because of the new additions to the roster or...
Because football.
It's just football in general?
And I think the roster too. I think...
Or is it by comparison to Stanford football?
Oh no.
I had reached a point where like every season they had Pete Carroll and Geno Smith and John Schneider, it was just hard to like get super excited. And I think maybe I talked myself into it a little bit last season because Ryan Grubb's gonna come in and fix everything and it's gonna look amazing like the Huskies offense did the year before. That didn't work out well, but I'm ready to try again and hopefully this offensive coordinator change will be better. And there's definitely things to be concerned about, like what will this offense look like without DK Metcalf, who was probably their most valuable non-quarterback player last year. So lots of question marks on receiving core, offensive line, but it's different and it's football and it's Seahawks 49ers. So sign me up for all of that this weekend.
The offensive coordinator change feels a little bit, even what you're saying, but it might work for us. And
yes.
I think people have very much bought into that, and I do think that's a lot of the excitement. Obviously, the defense in general, but the offense. If we're just going to wipe the Jalen Milroe third game from the record, but from the first two games in the zone blocking scheme that the Seahawks had, I do think that's a lot of the excitement around the team. I guess should we start on offense? I mean,
wait. I want to go there. I have a modest proposal for the preseason that I came up with after watching Hard Knocks last night.
Wow. Okay.
Should be able to self-select their opponents based on whether they want to play their starters in the preseason or not. Because, like, the Bears starters are marching the ball up and down the field against the Bills backups, and it's like, this didn't actually tell me anything. I want to see the Bears backups play against the game where the Seahawks are playing, or Bears starters play against the game where the Seahawks are playing their starters, not, you know, the Chiefs without their star players. Like, let's have actual head-on-head competition. And then if you don't want to play any of your starters, you go to the Sean McVay division and you just play your backups against each other.
Seems terribly complicated logistically. I don't know. Because what if you want, before the season
or whatever? You can decide.
I don't know when
you negotiate with opponents. You just,
I mean,
pull
that's basically
upon
what they do with open practice, with the practices. That
no,
they
what
do.
You do with open practices is just get in fights.
I mean, that's valuable too. We were more
yeah,
excited.
I was almost wondering if maybe the future is just you do your open practices and scrimmages, but the NFL makes money from selling tickets to preseason games that season ticket holders have to buy, right? So the formal games themselves probably won't.
I mean,
go
they're getting rid of one game. They're going to be down to two games come a couple of years from now. So
when they expand to the 18 game season,
yeah, when they expand to 18 games, it's going to be one preseason game that people have to buy per team. So, like, I do think the value of that, you know, the grift of it is kind of like it decreases things.
But I'd say before we talk about the offense specifically, let's start with the off season, because we have
that's where I want to say. I mean, a lot of it is the off season, right? Like,
without question, the offense and the off season overlap a lot because that's where the dramatic changes happened. The defense is largely status quo, but I also want to fold into there, like, we were thinking, you know, John Schneider is making a big bet on Sam Darnold. If this season doesn't go well, you got rid of Pete Carroll. You did the thing. You got rid of Russell Wilson first. You got rid of Pete Carroll. You then, you know, get rid of Geno Smith. If the results stay exactly the same, at some point the common denominator here is John Schneider is the one holdover here from the Legion of Boom era. Other than, I guess, Jaron Reed tangentially has some ties to it. Probably not that influential on the record. And instead, the Seahawks extend John Schneider with, like, the longest contract possible. So where are you about that big picture in the offseason?
That's a good way of framing it. And I've been not all in on John Schneider for quite some time. The drafts were very frustrating for a long time. And as we talked about a lot on this podcast, when Pete Carroll was here, it's hard to separate, like, how much of this was Pete Carroll, how much of this was John Schneider. Everything that we've heard, especially since Pete Carroll left, suggests that a lot of it was, like, they were always on the same page, but it was, like, John Schneider running the ship. So when we're talking about reaching for players and the insane trades, it sounds like, yes, Pete had final say in everything, but a lot of it was John doing what general managers do, which is shaping the roster of the team. And there has been a lot to criticize over the years with how much they've invested in the offensive line, the ill-fated trades using first round draft picks. And yes, if the results don't improve, then it raises the question of how if the ownership has championship expectations, and year after year they're on the border of the playoffs, mostly not making the playoffs, and if they get in, they get beaten very badly in the first round a couple years ago, then it seems like a mismatch, but they're not showing any signs of moving on for the general manager. And the quarterback part is interesting because moving on from Russell Wilson, in hindsight, worked out for them 1,000%. Like, they got two first round picks for a player who's clearly declining. I think it's possible that the Geno Smith thing will also work out. They only got a third round pick for him, but he's 35 years old. He got a lot of money. If he doesn't look like a world beater in Las Vegas, nobody's going to be pointing at John Schneider saying, how dare you let Geno Smith go? So here we are with Sam Darnold, and yeah, we'll see how all of this goes this year. I'm concerned about the receiving core that Seattle has relative to what Darnold enjoyed in Minnesota last year, but that's one of the reasons I'm so excited to see how this team looks when they actually start playing the games.
Here we are with Sam Darnold, the 2025 Seattle Seahawks. Yeah, I feel like one of the ongoing big picture debates about the NFL, this is something that Tristan and I have discussed a lot offline, is just how much credit for quarterback results are we willing to give to the infrastructure around them, whether that be the offense in which they play or the receiving talent or the offensive line. And the tape people are willing to give like 90% of the credit to all those other things, unless the things are going well for the quarterbacks they like, in which case it's all them.
Wait, say that again. People are willing to give credit. The tape people are willing to give credit to everything else around a quarterback, because I think you're right. However, and the second part was the most important thing, which is it depends on your narrative about that person.
Right. Does it confirm your priors or not? Yeah. So if it's a Brock Purdy having a tremendous success in terms of the metrics on rbsdm.com, your website, then, well, that's simply a product of Shanahan and the yards after catch. But if, you know, Matthew Stafford is putting up bad results, then, well, it's because of the fact that the talent around him is not good enough or that sort of thing. So, you know, where are you at on how much of a quarterback's performance we should attribute to the quarterback themselves?
Those are the exact two names and the exact two examples I was thinking of too. So definitely on the same page there.
You are a brother after all.
Yeah. I think it's a really good question and it's really hard to know the answer. And I also am often a little bit frustrated with kind of the quote unquote discourse with how that plays out. Like if it's someone that people have a good opinion on, then they, and he does well, then they attribute like all of the success to the quarterback and not like the system. Like for Matt Stafford, he has Sean McVay, he had Cooper Kupp when Cooper Kupp was good, he has Puka Nacua, but when that offense does well or did well, oh, it's because Matt Stafford is amazing and he's a good quarterback. But it seems like an unequal standard when it's applied to Brock Purdy, especially when their whole team got injured and their offense was still pretty good. It's still, oh, he's only doing good because of Kyle Shanahan, when we're not saying the things
about this
Stafford
question.
And McVay. Yep.
Does it matter? Does it matter?
It matters, like, when you're deciding what contract to give Sam Darnold.
Sam Darnold still got paid. You know what I mean? It's not like Sam Darnold is, he's on maybe a little bit of a prove it contract, but Sam Darnold's not making the minimum. Sam Darnold's not making $5 million per year, something like that. He's not even making Justin Fields money. Like, Sam Darnold still got paid. Brock Purdy, right? There's so much dialogue that exists about Brock Purdy on the internet. Brock Purdy is one of the highest paid quarterbacks in the league.
Tua got paid. Goff got paid.
I
agree with Kevin
discourse,
in that it matters with whether you expect Darnold to do what he did in Minnesota last year.
I think that's almost like a different question, though, because the question is not how much do we value these things. The question is, how well do we think Sam Darnold is going to do here? And it's a combination of both of those things, right? It's a combination of the talent around him and, you know, how we view Sam Darnold or whatever. But like, I'm a little bit like, I feel like it's a conversation that exists in here in the computer more than it does in the real world. And what really matters in the real world and the playing the football games is how good is the quarterback playing, right? And I think sometimes those evaluations take time to catch up with the performance, right? So somebody like Jared Goff kind of got the stink on him at the end of his Rams tenure. And maybe it was because of the beginning of his Rams tenure that happened. And then Jared Goff had a couple of good seasons in a row for the Lions. Now Jared Goff is he doesn't have that same level of kind of like stink on him necessarily. So I think it's basically a combination of on the field performance plus time. That is how this happens. But like, when we're talking about Sam Darnold, it doesn't matter how people are viewing him or whatever. It matters on how good Sam Darnold is going to do on the Seahawks. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes. And I would say that how well he does on the Seahawks might depend on the extent to which the surrounding situation is worse in Seattle relative to Minnesota.
Yes.
And we will find that out.
I guess I'm agreeing with that piece. And I think that does matter. But I also think the conversation about how we judge players just doesn't change things. And it's something that is fun to do in the offseason, but now Sam Darnold has to go try to win games. And that's kind of the point that we're at. And I'm kind of, and so I think my question for you, Ben, is how do we view Sam Darnold within the Seahawks offense? We know the 14-3 record last year. We know the roster that he's coming towards. What do you think about Sam Darnold in general for the Seahawks? And then also the Seahawks' decision to move from Geno Smith to Sam Darnold this offseason, especially process-wise.
Yeah, I think the decision about quarterbacks is totally reasonable. Even if Geno Smith looks a lot better than Sam Darnold this year, which I think is possible, but probably not super likely. I think they're probably in about the same tier of quarterback, although they both have a lot of question marks for various reasons. But Geno Smith is older. He's probably not going to be the Seahawks quarterback of the future for the next 5 years or whatever. And with Sam Darnold, we at least have that chance, and he's young enough where it's possible he's grown, and what we saw in Minnesota last year is more representative of what to expect from him going forward than what we saw earlier in his career. So if you can get a third round pick and get younger at quarterback and take a dice roll on somebody who's younger and possibly has a wider range of outcomes, then sure, that sounds good. I'm not going to argue with that. And I'll even say that I'm supportive of what they did with that. In terms of what to expect from Darnold, I think it's really hard because there's a lot of evidence that, like, the numbers that we have to measure players, especially quarterbacks or anybody really, it does not quote unquote follow them from one team to another. And I'm sure you've seen this to some extent with NBA players as well, Kevin, but just because you perform at a certain level or you have certain efficiency in some team environment doesn't mean that you're going to continue to have that performance or efficiency in a new environment if your role changes or your surrounding cast changes or something like that. So I think it's valid to ask to what extent was Darnold's performance last year driven by having at worst the second best receiver in the game and what was probably a pretty good offensive system. Their defense was pretty good for a lot of the year, so they were playing from advantageous situations a lot of the time. And yeah, maybe the Seahawks defense will be good, but their receiving core is JSN and a bunch of question marks. They don't have the kind of Justin Jefferson level receiver. So I think it's possible that he will play as well as he did in Minnesota, but I'm also somewhat nervous about how he'll actually look in games.
Well, let's dig down on that, because I mean, one of the things that we do find in NBA analysis is there are certain skills that tend to be more stable changing teams than others. So, you know, the rate at which you attempt threes, your rebound percentage, unless you're sort of an extreme specialist, like those are probably going to play, stay pretty similar. Your efficiency Your efficiency as a score is less likely to stabilize. So what are those factors if you break it down for NFL quarterbacks in that way?
When I looked at this, the most stable factor was perhaps surprisingly CPOE. So this is like how many more completions over expected given target depth and location someone was. And after thinking about this more, I think this makes sense. So CPOE is basically trying to capture accuracy. So if you can throw the ball to where you want it to go, then that is probably a skill that's going to translate from one team to another. Things like EPA and DVOA, those were less stable from team to team. And I think that also makes sense because those are influenced a lot by your pass protection and receivers and things like that. So for Geno Smith, he's very accurate. CPOE always loved him. That will probably translate from one place to another. But actually don't remember what Sam Darnold's CPOE was.
It was pretty good.
But things like... Okay, we'll take it. As long as it wasn't driven by Justin Jefferson being amazing, then maybe that's like a small signal that maybe some things will translate to the Seahawks.
And better than Kirk Cousins in 2022 when the Vikings were also very successful. So there you go, Kirk Cousins.
Hey, here we go.
I'm sorry, Sam Darnold, let's go.
Yeah.
What do you think of the Clint Kubiak system? Because there definitely has been this philosophy, especially based on the results of the first 2 weeks of the preseason, like, oh, obviously this is the best system to run. And, you know, the Kubiak system is at the core, essentially, of the Shanahan McVay trees. Like there's strong influence, you know, through the Washington Commanders coaching staff when Mike Shanahan was the head coach there and had Kyle Shanahan as offensive coordinator and McVay on the staff, you know, that aligns with the Kubiak dating back to Denver. But at the same, my counter argument is like, well, if this was obviously just the best system, everyone would run it. Like, well, it can't be a magic bullet. And obviously, last year's Saints results suggest that if you don't have the talent, particularly a quarterback, it doesn't matter how good the scheme is. So, where are you at on that?
Yeah, the Saints are interesting because they were incredible for the first, what is it, like 2 weeks of the season or 3 weeks of the season, and then everybody got injured and then they were not good. So yes, you definitely need some baseline level of offensive line play and quarterback play, or nothing is going to work in the NFL. But I think from a data standpoint, the one thing we can say is like the most times, or as many times as you can get under center and do play action on early downs, that's like the one thing we know that is extremely advantageous. And what was so frustrating about the Seahawks last year is they just basically never did that. So if they can find a way to do that and the offensive line can actually hold up, which is, I don't think we've talked about the offensive line yet, but that was another question mark this year and weakness last year, is if they can do those and get those shot plays like the Saints did last year, then that is definitely what we want to see. And hopefully without DK Metcalf, there's somebody else to take advantage of those opportunities this year.
How ready do you think JSN is to step into that role as the guy offensively? I mean, he was pretty much ostensibly the number one receiver in the second half of last year with DK Metcalf, probably as more of a 1A.
I think he will get a lot of targets and be very good with those targets, but he's not kind of the really fast guy that is going to make defenses be very cautious about how many deep safeties they're having on the field. And I think that's my concern about the offense, is there were a couple games where DK Metcalf looked or missed last year. I think the Bills game was one of them, and there were other issues with that game. I think it was raining and it was just not a good game. But the offense, if there's nobody to put fear into defenses, then they're just going to sit on the short and intermediate routes, not feel threatened over the top, and it's going to be make things really hard. And that's one of the elements that DK brought to the offense that didn't, even when he wasn't getting targeted, defenses just had to be aware of where he was lining up and the threat that he posed. And I don't think JSN, he's just not that kind of guy. He's not as fast. He's a better route runner. He's very good at a lot of things, but he won't replace DK Metcalf in that sense. He'll be the number one receiver, get the most targets, but hopefully there's somebody else. Not it was Marquez Valdes-Scantling that got
That's
cut,
what they
right? Not
said, but
him.
yes.
Someone else who will threaten defenses in that way. There must be, because if they cut him, they have to have some plan. They know everything that I'm saying, so hopefully there's some plan there.
I mean, Torrey Horton clearly is the plan based on what we saw from him in the preseason. What would you have been willing to offer Cooper Kupp as a free agent?
That's such a
A
hard
lot
on-the-spot
less
question
than
to
what they
ask.
gave him.
It got the answer it needed.
I just talked about their wide receivers for like 2 minutes straight, and I completely forgot that he's on the team. So that probably
Know
tells you that tells you my answer.
if
If he's
anybody
going to
could
be taken
come
at
up
the
with
top
like
often.
a matter of fact, like how much guaranteed, how much dead money, like
That's not what I was asking.
okay, all of those things considered, offensive line seems healthier, definitely steadier than it has been in the past. Is our expectation for a stronger offensive line? I think it almost has to be, but like, is the expectation for a stronger offensive line this season?
Yeah, I would hope that Abe Lucas is healthier than last season, because he didn't play for a lot of the season and then he clearly wasn't himself even when he came back. So hopefully after an off season and to recover and starting from the beginning of the season, hopefully things will go better for him this year. And I think Charles Cross is probably one of the best, certainly one of the most valuable Seahawks players. So if they were able to go back to having two starting quality solid tackles, that goes a long way. And hopefully the interior is better than last year as well, as they have made a lot of changes there. Is it Greg or Gary? The draft pick.
Gray Zabel?
Zabel. Yeah,
Gray.
Gray. Oh wow, I was 0 for 2. Gray
You
Zabel.
have assuming consuming the Gray Zabel
I know. You said you were excited
I
about the Seahawks.
yeah. Well,
He's been busy
so I
playing
was
Catan.
context for the listener here. So I'm out of town for like almost all of August every year. So I see almost very almost zero preseason, but I saw some clips of Gray Zabel pile driving people, and there's a new center also from the same school, right?
Not from the same. Well, he didn't finish. No, I guess he is from the same school. Yeah.
Okay. So,
Jalen
yeah.
Sunnell is
So,
the center, for the record.
yeah. So there's three things I saw from preseason. Yeah. One was Zabel. Two was the center. Some good highlights there. And then the Jalen Monroe highlights where I asked people to send me those. So that's everything I saw from
Milrow.
preseason. Yes. Jalen Milroe.
I did want to come back to Darnold for one second because you mentioned CPOE, and I think the thing that people, the way that people have talked about Sam Darnold is basically there was this one season in Minnesota, and we talked about this back when the Seahawks signed Sam Darnold, right, and made this transition from Darnold to Geno Smith, which was, this isn't just one single season. He was actually pretty good his last season as a starter in Carolina. And I distinctly remember him being with San Francisco. And there was like a risk of Brock Purdy not playing in a game. And I was like, dear God, I hope that they don't realize that Sam Darnold was good. And like, I think that this is just a sneaking suspicion. I think Kyle Shanahan would have been very comfortable going into big games with Sam Darnold as starting quarterback in those situations. And so I pulled up CPOE for those three seasons, the last season in Carolina, the season with San Francisco, and then last year in Minnesota. And when you look at it, 500 plays, you got to get rid of your Nick Mullinses and your sadly Jake Brownings to get out of the mix. CPOE. He ranks fourth in the NFL. Now, if you're making an argument about this transition, number one in the NFL is Geno Smith. So, but even if you look at those two quarterbacks, if you want to make an argument that the two of them are relatively similar, Sam Darnold is cheaper and way younger. And you get way more flexibility with Sam Darnold. So if it's, I mean, it's one full completion percentage less from Geno Smith at 4.7 plus completion percentage over expected. But then it's like Jalen Hurts, Joe Burrow, Jayden Daniels, Tua, Brock Purdy, Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen is number 11, and Ross is number 10. These are not bad quarterbacks in this mix. And it's almost like, you know, if you would, if it was like, the whole list was Daniel Jones or something like that, you'd be like, okay, I'm a little bit more skeptical about the predictive value of this. But ultimately, it's basically the best quarterbacks in the league who are in this tier. And I think it makes sense what you're talking about as this being a predictive thing. And I do think that Darnold has, there's more to it than just one season. I think the Seahawks got lucky here. And I think the Seahawks lucked into a situation where the Vikings probably would have been fine keeping Sam Darnold. Obviously, last season ended very badly, but they had JJ McCarthy that they had to do something with. And it was basically like they had to move to JJ McCarthy. They'd spent the fourth pick in the draft on him. It was a thing that just needed to happen at that point. And most of the teams around the NFL were pretty set at quarterback, especially after they traded Geno Smith to the Raiders. There weren't that many places for him to go. And for whatever reason, the Saints and the Browns wanted to deal with whatever they're dealing with right now. More on that on the over-unders. But I do feel like I got a little bit excited about the Seahawks when you were talking about all of these different things. We haven't mentioned the running backs. Your whole website is basically the reason that we haven't, but obviously Sharp for life. And when I look at the combination of the offensive line plus Darnold in a system that's going to set him up in a situation where he's going to have a phenomenal completion percentage with the Seahawks, he may top his career high from last season. But I look at the offense and I'm like, I think this offense could be at least top 12 in the league, something like that, if the line stays healthy and Darnold does what he's supposed to do. Maybe that's wishful thinking and maybe that's too rosy of a perspective about it. But I think given all of those changes and with Darnold, I think this offense looks pretty good.
That's too optimistic. One of the factors in the Seahawks consistently having a high CPOA in the Pete Carroll era, extending to the first year of the Mike Macdonald era, has been Tyler Lockett. And we like sort of have glossed over. Obviously, Tyler Lockett's role in the offense changed pretty dramatically last season with JSN's emergence and the fact that he was doing a lot of the Tyler Lockett things in the offense. But it was also really nice to have two of Tyler Lockett's,
Sam
you know.
Darnold didn't have Tyler Lockett, though. I guess that, I mean, if you want to give Geno credit for that for those three seasons, Sam Darnold wasn't playing with Tyler Lockett in Carolina, San Francisco, or Minnesota.
He wasn't. It's true. But I just wanted to say some nice things about Tyler Lockett here,
Sure.
Ben. So.
So I guess overall, what is your expectation then? If that's where I'm at, and Kevin says I'm being too rosy, what is your expectation, Ben, for the offense?
Yeah, I was thinking last year we did over-unders for the rank of the Seahawks offense and defense. So what would be a fair over-under of the Seahawks offense? Let's say if the over-under were, and let's say we're looking at like EPA per play at the end of the year. For the offense, if I said 14 and a half and the defense I said 6.5, what would you guys say for if would you take the over or the under for those? Like
I
for
mean,
better or worse?
it's hard to say over or under because being lower is better, but you've described a pretty good team there, 14 and a half and 6.5, if those are your expectations. And as we will talk about, those do not jibe with what the market is thinking about the Seahawks. I would take the under on the defenses on the offense as far as the offense being worse than that. I was thinking the line would be around like 18 and a half, frankly. And if they get For the
to
offense.
average, if they get to average, I think it's been a good season for the Seahawks offense. That's probably fair. Yeah.
I think they're a better offense and a slightly worse defense. 6.5 is, I mean, that's a
Maybe
lot
that
of
was aggressive.
confidence in this defense.
I've seen so many in my brief time online, people like Seahawks are going to be a top two defense, a top three defense. And you can't project any defense to be like a top three defense because defense is just too noisy. But I've seen so much optimism about the
I mean, if your bad case
Seahawks
scenario is they're the
defense
8th best defense, then I will take that.
year.
Sign me up for sure.
Well, that's a below average, I guess, if you're setting the line at 6.5. The bad case is, you're average at best, probably.
I mean, the bad case is always the worst team, but
I'd be pretty surprised if they managed to get to 32nd on defense. I'm going to give them that.
Helton casts any chance rule.
What week did Ernest Jones join the Seahawks defense so that I can look up the splits after they added him? Week 7, looks like. So overall, defensively, to your point, they finished last season in EPA per play, 10th overall. So even 8th would be a slight improvement. But again, if you look at that kind of that second half of the season, once they got established, made the changes at linebacker, then they did. I mean, Ernest Jones being the more impactful one, but Tyrese Knight coming in later, they were 8th over Jones's span on the team. And then in the second half of the season, weeks 9 through 18, they bumped up a little bit all the way to 5th. So that's, I think, where the optimism is coming from people. But still, the idea that you should expect them to be a top two defense, as you're saying, is unrealistic. Like, what percentage of top five defenses turn over from one year to the next in EPA?
Oh, a lot. Yeah.
So.
It's much less stable than offense because offense is mostly driven by the quarterback and there's no equivalent on defense.
Who do you think is the most important player for the Seahawks defense?
That's a good question. Probably Leonard Williams.
I mean, I
That's
think there's,
because interior pass rush is so important. Sorry, go ahead.
yeah, I think Sean Casey's the best player on the Seahawks defense. I mean, I feel like in terms of upside, you're probably either looking at Devin Witherspoon potentially having a bigger season like his rookie campaign, or Uchenna Nwosu getting healthy, like something to really elevate the pass rush into the elite level.
I mean, what about Byron Murphy then also?
Potentially, yeah. I
Yeah,
mean,
yeah.
I
You sort of kind
important is
of.
such a hard way to describe it because like Leonard Williams is going to be good. Devin Witherspoon is going to be good. And
Leather Williams was much better last year than he was in 2023, and that
yes.
was important for the Seahawks improvement.
But I think we can slot Leonard Williams and Spoon in as like good players. And I think important is kind of the way to describe that is basically, and I think maybe even Ernest Jones as well, right? But important is like if Byron Murphy takes a leap, then they can be that top two or three defense that you're talking about, something like that. Even if Reek Mullen has a phenomenal season, like the I think, or Nick Emenwori, I think there are a few players where it's like if they find kind of like gems in these other places from that we know generally what we're going to get from a handful of defenders, but it's a little bit about the fringes, the players who haven't fully shown it yet. And then we know Byron Murphy has potential, and he showed some of that potential last year.
I was thinking important, more like if this player got injured, we'd be in huge trouble.
I mean, that's probably also Ernest Jones, because you look at the depth at off-ball linebacker, it is not there.
Probably the
You get Cole Griffin. What are you talking about?
cornerbacks
On the practice squad?
I mean, I still think he's probably more likely to play than the quarterback they added last week if there was an injury at that spot. I mean, one of the interesting things about the Seahawks is they have, a large number of potential free agents next season who they have not extended. Really the entire draft class of Boye Mav, aside from Charles Cross, who gets the 5th year option picked up in his contract. You've got Boye Mafe, Ken Walker III, Abe Lucas, Kobe Bryant, and Reek Woolen. Like, is the Seahawks think about extending those players and how you're building, maintaining this core going forward? Who's the most important? Who are the most important players from that group? Who should they be prioritizing?
My rapid answer was going to be Abe Lucas, but it's just so hard to know where he's at medically, and I guess we'll find out a lot this season. If he can play through a whole season and there's no concerns, and he looks like he did in his rookie season before all the injury troubles, then nailing down your tackle pair for the next 5 or more years, I think could be very beneficial for the Seahawks. And then Tariq Woolen, I have no idea what to make of him. He went from like being very promising to getting benched to maybe being good again, but still having like not always being where he's supposed to be. I'm guessing if he hits free agency, he's going to get paid a gazillion dollars just because there aren't a lot of cornerbacks like him. And like I could see the Seahawks being priced out by him. So maybe they prioritize Abe Lucas and Tariq Woolen, and they'd say, thanks, but good luck elsewhere. But this is complete speculation at this point.
It probably depends on just how good they are, like is
That's fair.
as a defense as a whole, right? Like, if the defense is as good as we think it can be, if it's a defense that, like, defense first leads them to the playoffs, basically, like your over under you were saying, let's say that they're 14th offensively, 5th defensively, and they go 11-6, something like that. I think it's really hard to move on from Reek at that point. And especially if he's good. So I think Reek Willen is probably it. I mean, they obviously brought in a little bit of depth. Like, there's DeMarcus Lawrence, players like that, but Mafe is a fascinating one. I feel like Mafe may have hit kind of like the maximum of his potential right now, and they might be at it at the moment. He probably doesn't have as big of a market dollar as Reek has out there, especially with a good season. But I do think this is, I think defensively, as far as getting paid next year, I think Reek Woolen has the most to win or lose on the roster. And I think the overall success of the Seahawks defense is going to, and if he's good, I think it's going to affect what that number looks like for Reek the most.
Where are you at on the defensive metrics for cornerbacks? Because a lot of the, opponent completions, yards per, attempt to target against, show him is an elite cover corner. Do you buy those, or do you think that those are more scheme oriented, randomness, that sort of thing?
There's a lot that is extremely noisy from year to year. And I think a lot of this stuff is like yards per target against and PFF grade. I think the more stable ones are like not getting targeted in the first place. I think that's what a cornerback has the most control over. And I actually don't know where his numbers are. But even that is kind of dependent on like how good the cornerback across from you is. So if you have somebody terrible, then the quarterbacks are just going to throw at them, and it doesn't really tell you that much about how that cornerback itself is. Not necessarily the case in Woolen's case, but secondary play in general is really hard to come up with numbers without tracking data to tell how good people are.
Okay, so let's go back to the overall question. You set the line at 6.5 for the defensive rank. Where are you at on that?
I think we've discussed why that was a bad line. So
But I think it's a,
I'll
I think if we're doing like a market line, that's probably about where it would be. I guess, can we derive defensive strength from the season-long over-unders? I feel like maybe in what you reposted last week, that might be in there. Let me double check.
You can't, because all that markets project is like points for and points against, and points against is determined in part by how good the offense is and like how fast you play and stuff like that.
This is a good point.
unfortunately. Yeah, I think maybe a fair market over under would be like, I don't know, 9.5 or something for the defense. And if I said, let's pretend I said 9.5, and then I'll take better than 9.5 so I can be optimistic about something. What would you guys pick if it was 9.5?
Yeah, I'd go better than 9.5. I agree. I
Okay.
mean, the other thing is the Seahawks offense was rather old last year because of the fact that they had a 34-year-old or 35-year-old quarterback, whatever Geno Smith was at that point. The defense is pretty young and should hypothetically be improving from that standpoint.
Same with
So,
year two of Mike Macdonald, like more
yep.
time in his system, being able to bring in players, draft players that he wants to have in the system, people understanding it. Obviously, in Baltimore, it happened very, very quickly. But it happened pretty quickly in Seattle, too. I mean, their defense year over year was quite a bit better statistically with Mike Macdonald, and they got better throughout the season. So I understand why people have that perspective overall.
Protecting defense is so hard because a lot of how good the defense ends up being is just how healthy they stay, and especially if they can avoid getting a lot of injuries at one position group. And it's just like at this point, it's not something we can predict. So just hope for the best.
They have a couple of older important players on defense, but for the most part, a lot of the core on defense is fairly young. Obviously, DeMarcus Lawrence is quite a bit older. Leonard Williams, Jaron Reed. Leonard Williams is only 31, but then the secondary is pretty young and linebacker is pretty young. So, and I think they have the most depth on the defensive line and pass rush as well. So it's kind of like they can withstand some of those injuries where they are older. But obviously, we can't project those things specifically, but I think the Seahawks are in a very good position right now defensively.
I did want to circle back, by the way. I didn't mention this. So the 2 weeks that DK Metcalf missed last season, obviously the Buffalo game, they really were dreadful offensively. They played a close loss against the Rams without him the following week, but
Oh,
still,
that's the pick six game. Yeah. Sorry.
still in part because of that, if you look at their EPA per play offensively from the 2 weeks, they ranked 32nd in the NFL in that span. So not great. They were 10th in special teams. DVOA last year. Is there any stickiness year to year in that, or obviously we know with kickers there's very little carryover, and then coverage games is pretty small sample sizes.
Punting is very consistent from year to year, and the Seahawks have a good punter, so they do have that going for them.
Who they're paying a lot of money. Okay, so what you have described, we've taken a top 10 defense for the Seahawks, an offense that I think we generally think can be around league average. This should be, a team that is looking at 9-8, most likely, maybe 10-7 again. And instead, the over-under for the Seahawks is 7.5 wins. Like, is 8.5 wins, I should say. But there's heavy action on the under. Is
Heavy
Vegas
action on the
again missing?
under.
Yes. Is Vegas
Wow.
again missing? Yeah. I mean, the Seahawks are the consensus fourth best team in the NFC West. Or the Seahawks being underrated again by the markets.
I'm guessing markets are a lot lower on the Seahawks offense than we are. And as you just said, two game sample, but without DK Metcalf, they were the worst offense in the league last year. So some skepticism is warranted there. And yes, they changed the quarterback, they changed the offensive coordinator, they tried to fix their offensive line. But if the Seahawks had the 20th or 25th best offense, we'd be disappointed, but probably not surprised. So I'm guessing that's where the Vegas thinking comes from.
Let me ask if they did have the 20th, or let's say they had the 20th best offense and the 5th best defense, does that still put them over?
Probably. Fifth best defense is a very good defense.
I think Sam Darnold is a little bit in prove it territory, Vegas wise. And
Yeah,
every
quite
question.
yet.
I mean, one of the other lowest odds across the league is Vegas as well, right? And where was Vegas? Oh God, it's one of these tabs.
Six and a half.
Yeah, 6.5 for Vegas was a little surprising in a roster that needs a bigger makeover than the Seahawks roster.
They did win 4 games last season, so 6.5 would be a big improvement.
It's definitely true. But it was with Aiden O'Connell, right? Like, yep, the quarterback yep. situation for Vegas was pretty bleak last year. I mean, what we were talking about with CPOE, like, I think Geno Smith and Sam Darnold, ironically, are two of the most underrated quarterbacks in the league. I think they're kind of underrated both teams in Vegas. I mean, how many times have the Seahawks beaten their over-under? It's been pretty consistent.
Yep. Yeah, I think they have.
Every season since they traded Russ, right?
It seems likely. Certainly they did in 2022. 2023 would probably be the biggest question mark.
I mean, they won 10 games last year, right? For a team, like, it doesn't sound right. I heard somebody say this, and I was like, that doesn't seem like the amount of games that they won, right? Because when you look back on the season, you're kind of like, oh, it was not a good season. They missed the playoffs, ultimately. But they did miss the playoffs yep. because of a few random other games that happened in Week 18. It was Week 18, right? We were completely down to the wire paying attention to some games.
No, it was Week 7.
They were eliminated before that, yeah.
Okay,
that they would make it to Week 18 when they would have
mattered. Or the Rams game against Jimmy G would have mattered
for a playoff spot, okay. potentially.
Yes.
And so instead, they faced a Rams team that had no incentive to win and still barely beat them in that final.
Fair enough.
Season. That's how they got to 10 games.
So the spread is 8.5 this year or 7.5?
The line is 8.5. Last year was 7.5, which they went 2.5 over last year. They were half over in 2023. And
okay.
then in 2022 they were 3.5 over.
So basically they lose one home game, which, let me tell you something about the Seahawks home games last year. Not great. If anybody remembers what that record was, I believe they had 2 home wins. I believe they were 2-7 at home last year. Is that correct?
I will double check that, but it definitely wasn't good.
No, that would have made them undefeated on their own. So they had 3 home wins last year.
Yes, they were 3.
They beat the Broncos, Dolphins, and Cardinals at home.
Yep.
They were a bad home team last year. I don't think that's, like, I wouldn't expect that to continue year over year, but they're playing the AFC South and the NFC South, and their extra games are, gosh, I thought they were pretty uniformly bad, the extra games that they play in the schedule.
It's
so.
Steelers is one.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'll be there.
Oh, really?
Look for me. Yeah.
Is it the Vikings, I believe, is another one. And the Commanders.
Yep.
So I think the Commanders are a team that's, I mean, I'm sure we'll get there soon. They feel like a pretty huge regression team. Year over year, the Minnesota Vikings might be a pretty huge regression team year over year. And then the Steelers, like, all three of those games, I'm like, they're definitely winnable games at the very least. Two of them are on the road, but those definitely feel like winnable games. And they're playing the worst two divisions. So part of me thinks that this might be true. The Seahawks may go over and still not make the playoffs again. They may go over by a game and a half and still not make the playoffs again. Because I think the entire NFC West may do a little bit better because of playing the two South divisions. But the schedule, just taking a glance at the schedule, the non-conference or the non-division games that are scary are none, really. They host the Buccaneers. I mean, I guess maybe at the Steelers. They host the Texans, which is the other hardest game. The two hardest teams that they play in the AFC South and NFC South are both at home. So that's something. The schedule just kind of worked out nicely for the Seahawks here, and they have to be about average in the NFC West games.
Yeah, if you look at the implied strength of schedule, this is what Ben reposted from Mr. Case B on Blue Sky. The easiest schedules in the NFC, the NFC East and NFC North all have monstrously difficult schedules, in part because of playing presumably each other. And then the NFC South teams have uniformly easy schedules. The Niners have by far the easiest schedule In the NFC, slightly easier than New England for the easiest overall. Then Arizona is a little bit easier, and then the Seahawks have the sixth, seventh easiest schedule in the NFC. So it works in their favor as you consider the wild card possibilities, but to your point, does not benefit them in winning the division other than maybe slightly relative to the Rams.
When also we're talking over unders too, over unders here too. Yeah, the Niners extra games are the at the New York Giants, who I think are frisky. I kind of like the New York Giants at the Giants, the Bears, who they host, and then the J. No, that would be a South game. I guess the Browns is the other one. So, I mean, they have some pretty terrible extra games. Look, it's good to tank. It's good to get that record or that schedule after the season that the Niners had. But all of those things lead to me to I feel like it's an over for the Seahawks, if that's what we're doing right now.
I'm a slight over. Yeah. I mean, especially because of the fact that the action has been on the under here, you know, given that it pushes me to the over for sure. Ben.
Yeah, how can I not say over? They can win nine games. The two South divisions, come
Pivoting to positivity here on the FalconCast.
I mean, I think my biggest question overall is just Clint Kubiak is in more of a prove it position than people are giving him credit for. He's coming in as he's got the name, obviously. And the scheme that you were talking about, the Saints were not a good offense last year. The Saints were a good offense for two games, but overall, and we could chalk it up to they just didn't have the talent to be a good offense. But like, it's one of those situations where I hear people talking about like rookie players who played well in the preseason, and they're just like chalk them up to being a factor. The Seahawks have one on their team, right? It's just like Torrey Horton's going to be a factor this year, and it's like maybe do it one time, you know? Like before we get there, you have to prove it a little bit. And I think Clint Kubiak with the scheme, like yes, it looks good in the preseason on a small handful of drives, but it's not an there are not that many teams out there using fullbacks across the league and who are doing it with a system like this. So I just, if I have any hesitations about it, it is basically just, can this offense work at the level that it needs to get them to the playoffs?
Well, for one, I'm hyped about Robbie Utes, so I'm all in on the fullbacks. Let's go. You know, who needs wide
I feel
receivers?
like we're three of the people who hate running the ball more than almost anybody.
But conversely, love play action more than anybody. So
Yeah.
it's a little bit of a 50-50 on this one.
Fair enough.
Right, Ryan Grubb. It was really kind of, you know, yeah, there was a lot of passing, but there was no play action. So we're going from one opposite extended. End of the spectrum to the other with this offensive coordinator change.
Or motion. I truly do not get it. I do not get what happened to Ryan Grubb.
Someday there'll be a tell-all book about it, perhaps.
No one cares enough. No one cares enough for there to be a tell-all book, but
They may care about the Alabama story, so it'll be folded into that, what happened to Ryan Grubb after he left UW. Anything else on the Seahawks, or should we get into the? Oh, there is one other thing on the Seahawks. As Ben reminded me before the pod, we have to look back on our predictions for who would return for the Seattle Seahawks this offseason, our percentage chances of returning. So conveniently, I have tallied this and do have results. All right, quarterback Geno Smith, Ben 95%, Tristan 90%, Kevin 85%, Mike Shawn 99%. Pretty big hit on that one. Third Felton feather, Mike Sean Dugar. Wide receiver Tyler Lockett, Ben 20%, Tristan 0% was accurate in his over extreme prediction. Kevin 25%, Mike Sean 10%. DK
Ewing wasn't coming
Metcalf.
back. I mean, you're just wasting percentages there.
I thought he could come back at a lower number.
Yeah.
Probably would rather have him than Cooper Kupp if we're being honest, but Cooper Kupp's blocking is
I'm
important to the
sorry.
scheme.
You are way too down. That is absurd that you would rather have Tyler Lockett than
Tyler
Cooper Kupp.
Lockett's is that a hot take? Tyler Lockett's actually had a low key had a better career than Cooper Kupp.
I don't care. Not necessarily career, but he was done last year. Let me pull up Tyler Lockett's stats from the
Wait,
second half
Kupp
of
or
last year.
Lockett?
Yeah, which stats are we pulling up here? Cooper Kupp got more targets than Tyler Lockett because he was playing with one elite receiver, and at some point due to injury, zero elite receivers as opposed to playing with two elite receivers. But
I'm just, his targets, it's like 4-3-3-3.
Sure, but tell me about the yards per target.
4-4. They were also bad.
They weren't good, but they weren't bad.
I mean, he gained no more than 28 yards after November 3rd. I think you're not realizing just how done Tyler Lockett was last year.
Again, I think you're not realizing that he was the number three receiver in an offense that had DK and JSN. But speaking of DK Metcalf, Ben, 95% chance of returning. Tristan, 100% chance of returning. Kevin, 80%. Mike Sean, 80%. Tight end Noah Fant, Ben, 40%. Tristan, 85%. Kevin, 65%. Mike Sean, 65%. Defensive lineman Jaron Reed, Ben, 55%. Tristan, 0%. Kevin, 45%. Mike Sean, 80%. Chenin Nwosu, Ben, 75%. Tristan, 85%. Kevin, 60%. Mike Sean, 90%. So I was off on that one. And then linebacker Ernest Jones, the fourth. Ben, 80%. Tristan, 100%. Kevin, 95%. Mike Sean, 99%. So that was a tough one for Ben. Your final score, if we add up the errors on each of these, Mike Sean, who did get the benefit of doing it a little later, I will say, although I don't think a lot changed between those times, at 2.85, Ben, 3.4, me, 3.55, and Tristan, because of his enormous misses, last in 3.99 at 3.9. Although I will note, Tristan was set to be second before Noah Fant got released. That took him from second to fourth.
He was sort of back. Some capacity.
It's opening day roster is what we decide this by.
Okay, Cooper Kupp went over 100 yards three times last year. Tyler Lockett, zero, including 104 yards against these Seahawks in a win. 92 yards on December 8th in a game that the Rams inexplicably beat the Bills, if we remember that one. I'm still mad about it. Uniformly saying that Tyler Lockett is going to be better than, like, I don't know if
Tyler Lockett averaged 8.1 yards per target. Kupp averaged 7.1.
Okay.
That's the
he
goal.
He wasn't being targeted. Also,
yeah, because there were other good receivers. It's not like
he wasn't
the Seahawks
open. What sort of bet do we have to place Cooper Kupp vis-a-vis Tyler Lockett for the season?
I mean, I don't know that I think Tyler Lockett is going to have a good season. I do think he's quite old and ineffective. It's just that I think Cooper Kupp is also ineffective, and Tyler Lockett is at least cheap while being ineffective.
They're the exact same age. A Cooper Kupp has more in the tank than Tyler Lockett has.
It was done. One blocker without question.
It was done for Tyler Lockett last year. I'm sorry. I'm shocked that he's still in the league.
What?
And playing with the number one pick.
All right.
Let's do
that. Always goes well. Old wide receivers with the Titans.
Just any wide receivers with the Titans, frankly. So we are doing these using the lines from ESPN Bet, and we'll go over, we'll score these using the actual over under the VIGs on those, even though we also are really mostly just trying to get these correct. All right, we start in the NFC West with the Arizona Cardinals, like the Seahawks, a line of 8.5 wins, but in their case, the action has been on the over rather than on the under. Ben, you want to start us off?
I've heard optimism about the Cardinals, and I can't say I fully understand it, so I will take the under.
I'm also going under on the Cardinals.
Yeah, I'm going under. If you're going to be over on the Seahawks, you probably got to be over on the Seahawks. You probably got to be under on someone else in the division in Arizona. I think it's the, well, I'm sure Tristan will be under on the Rams.
No, I actually don't know if I'm going to be under on the Rams. I mean, I guess going back to what you said, Ben, I'm not sure what happened in Arizona over the offseason that's going to make them. I mean, it's only a game better than they were to go to from 8-9 to 9-8, but they're also losing the home game. The same record stuff that the Seahawks have, so they may be over just because of the record or because of the schedule.
Right. They have a slightly easier schedule again than the Seahawks.
guess they had a better point differential than they had the best point differential in the division last year.
I'm going to move me to an over on the Cardinals. I may be over on every team in the NFC West.
Wow. Vegas has no idea what the schedule is, apparently. Their Pythagorean record was 8.5 wins with that best point differential in the division. At least that's what I have it as.
Yep.
All right, Atlanta Falcons, a line of 7.5 wins in Michael Penix Jr.'s first full season as a starting quarterback.
I guess they play in the NFC South, so
they do.
I guess that's why the line is high. This is hard. I guess I'll take the over and feel horribly about it.
Give me the over for the Falcons.
Oh, got to be an over here. They won 8 games with Kirk Cousins playing half the season.
They were over this number last year, just for what it's worth. We saw Kirk Cousins last season, who is their quarterback for most of the season. Michael Penix is going to be better than that. They spent 2 first-round draft picks on defensive players. Bijan, another year. Drake London. Like, this Atlanta team, I think they're going to win the NFC South. I mean, I made a bold prediction about it way back last December or January about the Atlanta Falcons, but this is not even necessarily just a Penix bold prediction, but I think that the Falcons, when you're changing from the corpse of Kirk Cousins to Michael Penix, it's going to be a good season for Atlanta.
All right, Baltimore Ravens, a line of 11.5 wins.
Whew. That's a lot, but the Ravens are very hard to play against in the regular season. I feel like they beat their line a lot of the time, and I believe in them more than the other teams in their division, so I'll take the over on them.
To me, the hardest ones are the really high and the really low lines, because it's basically like the Ravens could be 11-6, they could be 12-5, something like that. But I think this year, my general perspective has been going with the extremes. Like, I think the good teams are going to be better than their over-unders, and I think the bad teams are going to be real bad. And so give me an over for the Ravens.
I'm also going to take an over here. I feel like it's also just basically a bet on will they stay generally healthy in these situations. Buffalo Bills, a line of 11.5 wins.
A lot of what we talked about with the Ravens also applies. These high totals are hard. I like rooting for the Bills. I could easily see them finishing 11-6 and going under this, but for fun, I'll take the over here.
I mean, I think they were 13-4 last year.
Correct.
In a season that they kind of didn't play that well, right? Like, the Bills, they weren't in trouble and they finished really strong, but it wasn't their best regular season ever. Definitely give me an over on the Bills. I think it's basically just the Ravens and the Bills don't have a lot of competition in division either.
Easiest schedules in the NFL. San Francisco, as we mentioned, New England, and then Buffalo, the third easiest schedule, in part because they don't have to play themselves.
Sure.
Give me the over.
kind of absurd how that can work out.
Carolina Panthers, a line of 6.5 wins.
That seems pretty optimistic for how bad they were last year, and possibly overreacting to a few games where Bryce Young looked better. And as much as I'm rooting for them, it kind of hurts me, but I'm going to go, I'll believe it when I see it. So I'll take the under for them.
I am also going over. I think I've gone over on every single team.
You are 5 for 5 thus far. You have to take a lot of overs.
Going over on the Carolina Panthers.
I'm with Ben. I think people really want to believe it with Bryce Young, and I still, like, the large sample is still very troubling with Bryce Young. So I think, you know, I'm hopeful, but I'm going to take the under here. Chicago Bears, a line of 8.5 wins.
The NFC North, just like the NFC West, is hard because there's all these teams that are supposed to be pretty good and bunched up together. And I guess the Bears are the Seahawks equivalent of this division. With all that said, in their division, 8.5, I know there's the Ben Johnson's going to turn around Caleb Williams and it's going to look completely different. But This is another team where I'm going to go, I'll believe it when I see it. So I will take the under. 8.5 seems like a lot.
I'm gonna also go under on the Bears.
They have had about the most action on their under of just about anyone. I am going to not only go under, but I'm going to make this a lock. Shane Waldron did
Wow.
nothing wrong.
Bang. Shane Waldron did nothing wrong.
They've done a couple of things wrong. Cincinnati Bengals, a line of 9.5 wins.
This is a really interesting team. Last year, incredible offense, horrible defense, missed the playoffs, even though their offense is really good. On the one hand, they didn't do a lot of things that you would expect to make their defense much better, but defense is really uncertain. So, as much as I could see them going under, I will take the over for them. I think they could get to 10 games.
No doubt on the over for me. I don't want to do locks yet, but I think the Bengals and the Ravens are going to both win like 11, 12 games.
I think, look, to Ben's point to start this, offense is very predictable year to year. Defense is not. The situation you want to be in is to have consistently very good offense and hope the defense locks into a good year. Cleveland Browns, a line of 4.5 wins.
4.5. Oh my gosh. I already took the over on two teams in this division, the Ravens and Bengals. 4.5 is extremely low, but what are the Browns doing? How are they going to win games this year? I take the under and I'll feel horrible about it because this is an extremely low under, but I don't want to take the over on the Browns.
Dead last in DVOA last year, were the Cleveland Browns, and I just don't really see where it gets better for them right now.
Oh, Joe Flacco.
I mean, yeah, there's Joe Flacco. Had a conversation about Tyler Lockett and Cooper Kupp were done, but.
Joe Flacco is unquestionably an upgrade over the average quarterback play the Cleveland Browns got last year. Yeah.
I'm not sure about that, and I'm also not sure if he's good enough to like they'll still lose games with Joe Flacco, even if it's better than the quarterback play that they got. And then I will say this, I am a Dylan Gabriel believer. Like the way that I would be nervous about it is if Dylan Gabriel plays a bunch of games. But I'm
A
going
lot
under.
of action on the over here for us having ta all taken the under here. What I will say is, I don't think the Cleveland Browns want to win five games. I think they want to have the number one pick in next year's NFL draft. And if Joe Flacco starts cooking a little bit too much, we're going to see some rookie quarterbacks and maybe multiple rookie
I don't
quarterbacks.
know if that's true. I don't feel like that's in teams' DNA. Like, I don't think that there are people in the front office who definitely in the back of their heads are like, we wouldn't mind being terrible this year. But overall, organizationally, institutionally,
I
they are
think
going into the
in
season
Cleveland,
trying
those
to
people
win.
run the team. We've seen it before. Hate to break it to you.
I'm not, it hasn't gone well when we've seen it before. I mean, Miami
I
was
agree with that.
the last team that like
I'm
fully
saying
tanked.
in Cleveland, we've seen it before.
They're not happy with that.
Dallas Cowboys, a line of 7.5 wins.
I think I took the Cowboys over lock last year and it did not end well.
Oh, that's right, because there was the game. It was you took Steelers under as a lock, and the Cowboys and Steelers played a game very late on Sunday night when I was flying to Europe, and the Cowboys won at the end of it and seemed like a huge win for you, and then did not matter at all.
Nope, not even close. There's a lot of reasons to be worried about the Cowboys, but they still have Dak Prescott. They still have CeeDee Lamb. They added George Pickens. Maybe their offense will be really good. 7.5 is pretty low. They did lose Micah Parsons, but I'll take the over.
Wow. Can I ask you, Ben? I've been waiting to ask your perspective about the Micah
Brian
Parsons
Schottenheimer, I
trade.
forgot. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, Brian Schottenheimer, too.
Sorry.
I've been curious to ask your perspective about the Micah Parsons trade, though, overall, because I feel like Kevin and I are like in the extreme minority on it.
It has been interesting seeing the Cowboys universally panned and the Packers praised because I kind of thought we had reached a point where we thought that sending multiple first round picks to sign a player to a market-setting extension who's a defensive player is like it's very, very hard to make it work out. So I think that's the baseline. I am sympathetic to the arguments that, like, you never see a player of Parsons' caliber traded. He's like 26 years old. He's at worst a top two pass rusher, and like maybe his impact on the game, for anyone who hasn't read Bill Barnwell's piece in the aftermath of this, it was really good about laying out just how much he's impacted the Cowboys defense. I think it's very easy to say this time is different for reasons X, Y, and Z, and you can talk yourself into all of these. I'm sure many Seahawks fans did this about the Jamal Adams trade. But this time, I think maybe it really is different just because pass rush is very consistent. Like, players that are good at pass rushing in 1 year are very good at pass rushing in the next year. He's young, he's in his prime, and he's on a Hall of Fame track. So if I were the Packers and I were presented this opportunity, then I think I would consider it much more than like many of the past trades we've seen for defensive players. Where did you guys end up landing on this?
Just like we need to take a beat at the very least. I don't know whether I would have done it as the Packers or not, but like everything was so making fun of the Cowboys and the Packers are such huge winners. Like let's move a little bit, progress that opinion to the mean.
I just think any time that you're giving two first round picks for the privilege to pay somebody the most money for a defender ever is you're in the wrong in that situation. Like the flexibility. I mean, I was thinking about this from the Cowboys perspective, and I'm sure that there are Cowboys fans out there who thought that they had a chance to win a Super Bowl or compete for the NFC. They didn't, you know, and Vegas would have told us before this whether they did, right? And like realistically, Washington last year, I don't know, it happens. But like the amount of teams that are not in, say, the top 10 for over-unders projections who go to a Super Bowl, win a Super Bowl is never, right? And so, where the Cowboys were with that roster, with Micah Parsons, is what's the difference to me if you're the Cowboys? Like, is he worth a win? Is he worth two wins? If you had to assign like value to Micah Parsons, I just would be shocked if any individual defensive player was worth more than one win. And if that's the case and you're giving up two first round picks, which the flexibility that the Cowboys can use for those first round picks, I mean, you've done research on this. The most valuable picks you can have are at the end of the first round. Obviously, like if they're early first round picks, that's even better because then you can use them to trade back for picks at the end of the first round, et cetera. But like they can turn those two picks into a generation of players for the Cowboys that help them become a very good team. And Micah Parsons wasn't doing that for them right now.
I do think that's probably the portion of the what a lot of the analysis I saw misses is that everyone's like, oh, they're the Packers are giving up two late first round picks, which aren't that valuable. And A, late first round picks are very valuable, and B, you never know. There's always some probability that there's some disaster season. Nobody ever thinks they're going to be sending away a future top five pick, but sometimes it happens. You
The
just never know, even
Seahawks
with the
with the Jamal
Packers.
Adams trade.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, even a Jordan Love injury, I know they withstood a Jordan Love injury last year, but like it could derail things for a long time. I was trying to understand basically the Micah Parsons deal and how many years, you know, his cap hit is like 10 million this year, 20 next year, 26, and then it goes up to 64. That's probably they restructure at that point. Right after the 3 seasons, like they're not going to be taking him as 64 million as part of their cap, 17%. But it's still money that is going to linger on the books for the Packers for a long time. And if the Packers don't win a Super Bowl or compete for a Super Bowl right now, then I'm just like, he's already injured. He is currently injured. The deal that they signed him to is not a deal the Cowboys wanted to sign him to. So if the Cowboys didn't even want to pay him that money, bar none, you're willing to give up two first round picks to do a thing that the Cowboys wouldn't do. To me, I'm kind of like, this is just bad process, but we'll see.
I do think that part of it, and like Barnwell talks in the piece about, you know, the effective value of his contract when you count the two first round picks. But if Dallas had re-signed him, the two first round picks are still part of it because you could have traded him to someone else and gotten those. So either way, you're paying any player on your roster their trade value plus their actual contract. It's just like more implicit when you don't actually trade them. But anyway, let's get back to the 2025 Cowboys. Tristan, where are you at on this? Ben's an over.
I want to be an over so bad on the Cowboys and to believe in Shoddy and the offense, but I think I'm an under on the Cowboys.
I drafted Dak Prescott for the umpteenth year in a row in fantasy, along with CeeDee Lamb in the first round. So I'm all in on the Cowboys. Give me the over. I also have like one of their backup running backs.
Here's what I'll say is people were treating them like they're a joke, and I do not think the Cowboys are going to be a joke this year.
I mean, they might be. They're still the Cowboys. Just like their offense probably is not going to be a joke. Denver Broncos line of 9.5 wins after winning 10 in Bo Nix's rookie season.
The Broncos are another of these teams that, like, they were good primarily because of their defense. So I think a lot of this 9.5 is assuming their defense will be good and Bo Nix gets better in year two, none of which I think is guaranteed. So I'm more than happy to fade the Broncos and take that under here.
I'm going to take the over on the Broncos. AFC West, very similar to the NFC West. This is an extraordinarily hard division to judge, in my opinion.
Yep.
That was an under again?
No, I'm an over on the Broncos.
I'm an under. Broncos schedule, not as hard as you would think it is, but still going to be much harder than last year, presumably. Detroit, a line of 10.5 wins.
I think their offense should still be good, even after losing Ben Johnson. They still have all the pieces in place. I think they had some turnover on their offensive line too, but I think they should keep being strong. So I will take the over on the Lions.
What was the line again?
10.5.
I'm going to go an over on the Lions.
We're all over here. I think I've agreed with Ben every time, which is not going to make it easy for us to score this. Green Bay
Just
Packers.
Wait till we get to the Steelers.
Green Bay Packers, a line of 9.5 wins.
That seems pretty low, given. Yes, I think
heavy going back action to on the overs, you would imagine.
Micah Parsons' comment. I think he probably is worth a win, so I will take the over.
I would have been an over pre Micah Parsons at 9.5, so I'm an over also on the Packers.
I am over. Yeah, naturally.
I'll make them a lock. Green Bay Packers over 9.5 wins lock.
Houston Texans, a line of 9.5 wins.
They're talking about them feels very similar to the Broncos, where they had a very good defense. They have a young quarterback that, at least with CJ Stroud, we saw him. He was pretty good in his first year, and after a down year last year, I think we're probably assuming that he's going to improve. And their division is horrible, so I see the vision here. So what was it? 9.5 wins?
Yep.
I can't talk myself into it. I was trying to talk myself into it, but I can't do it. So I'll take the under.
I'm going over on the Texans.
Pythagorean record of 8 wins last year. So I'm taking an under here. Indianapolis, 7.5.
Daniel Jones. All of if I didn't plan ahead, I would probably take the under on every team in this division, but I have to go over on somebody, and it wasn't Houston, and it's not going to be Tennessee. So I'll take the over on the Colts, and there's no real good reason for this other than just thinking that none of the other teams in the division are going to be good.
Tristan?
I am an under on the Colts. I don't really know what people are seeing in this team, to be honest. Overall, the Colts are probably the least they're the least notable team in the league. Like, at least the Saints and the Browns are like seem like they might be kind of like historically bad, or they're going into the season with freaking, like, you know, Spencer Rattler or Joe Flacco as their quarterback. But the Colts are just normal boring. And the Anthony Richardson, Daniel Jones quarterback competition, I'm just not interested in. A pass, full pass on the whole thing. So I am definitely an under on this one.
I am also an under on this one. So Ben and I have finally parted. Kansas City.
I want to before
I'm
I
sorry, I've
forget,
skipped Jacksonville.
I want to go back and do a lock for the Texans over.
Okay. Oh, well, that's aggressive. A team where there's been action on the under. Jacksonville Jaguars, a line of 7.5 wins staying in the AFC South.
I still believe in Trevor Lawrence, and I don't believe in this division, so I will take the over because 7.5 feels kind of low, and I think they can get past that.
I just don't know. I'd give me an over for the Jags, but it is a hard, it's a difficult over.
I'm in the same boat. Reluctant over. Kansas City Chiefs, a line of 11.5 wins.
11.5 wins.
They won
That seems
15
high
last
for
year.
they won 50. Oh yeah, they're all close games and they
With
just
a point differential
kept
of a
doing
10
it.
win team.
Yeah. This is really hard. I guess I will take the over, even after being skeptical of the height of their over. I think, yes, there's a huge deal of randomness in close games, but I think you could probably make the case that having Andy Reid and especially Patrick Mahomes probably does give you a real advantage in these games. And somebody's going to pull up the numbers and make me look dumb, but that's what I'm going to go with.
I'm going to be an under for the Chiefs.
I'm a slight under here. Just, there's multiple outs to the under, I would say. Las Vegas Raiders, a line of 6.5 wins.
We talked about them winning four games last year, I think, although they didn't have a real quarterback, so it's a hard comparison to make. I think they could. It was 6.5, you said? I think they could get to seven. Sure, let's go with the over for them.
Give me an over for the Raiders. I mean, Pete Carroll on his own feels like he's worth 7 wins. Just the Pete Carroll way of
You're
doing
going
things.
to win 11? Is that what you're saying? Before you even factor in Geno? I am not only an over here. I am going to make this a lock. I've been
It
reading Win Forever.
really?
Let's
You're
go.
making this a lock?
I'm making this a lock.
Okay, I was thinking about, you just texted me, we had to hurry up, but I was just thinking about how the mirroring careers of Bill Belichick and Pete Carroll. And Bill Belichick didn't get the NFL job that he wanted, right? And now he is getting crushed in college games. Bill Belichick is kind of a joke
Crushing
right
college
now.
game.
We'll see, but like, I'm
It's only
not
been
feeling.
one, by definition.
Sure. The way that their careers since both being fired have mirrored each other, and how much better Pete Carroll's has looked, even though Bill Belichick is generally considered to be the greatest coach of all time, I think this is a really important season. For Pete and this tenure with the Raiders is a really important time period for Pete Carroll's legacy, where it's like Belichick never did it without Tom Brady, basically. And if Pete Carroll can put together a playoff team with the Las Vegas Raiders and Geno Smith, I think it really helps him legacy-wise. And I think Pete Carroll is keenly aware of that information.
I agree. Whether he can do anything to action that information is another question entirely.
He somehow can he can will them to an over. That is what Pete Carroll does.
I made them a lock, so I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that part of it is funny to me.
I don't know if I could get to a lock, but
Los Angeles Chargers, a line of 9.5 wins.
is another team that had a really good defense last year that I'm kind of skeptical of going forward. In theory, their offense should be better than it has been, but until that actually happens, I'm kind of skeptical. So 9.5 feels a little bit high to me. I will take that under.
give me an over on the Chargers. Ninth in DVOA last year. Rashawn Slater's hurt, but I think this team, year two of Jim Harbaugh, he's another coach. He's gonna find a way to get there.
That's where I'm at on this one. Also, I went under on two teams in the AFC West, so leaving it out. LA Rams, a line of 9.5 wins. And action surprisingly on the over here.
Yeah, that feels low. I guess the question is whether Matt Stafford is healthy. It's really hard to know at this point, but we haven't heard that he's not, although I don't know if we would. So I'll take the
He
over. I
gave
think
a press
they have a
conference
path to
today.
being pretty good.
I don't have to expand, but give me an under on the Rams.
I am under on the Rams. Miami, a line of 8.5 wins.
Miami's that team where like everything you've heard about them has been unencouraging, and I kind of understand why for various reasons, so I will take the under on them.
I'm also an under on Miami. I mean, this basically comes down to Tua's health in a lot of ways. I think people are a little too down on the Dolphins. If the line was like 5.5, 6.5, I'd be like betting the over, but
Well, yeah.
it's just
I
a
mean,
little bit too high of a line given everything.
if it
And
was
that you.
7.5, I'd be like over. But 8.5, yeah, I probably. This is the most action on any under in the
I'm gonna.
entire league.
Is it unfair to make this a lock? Is it too obvious?
No, because it's not like it's the reason is because of the fact that there was like the Green Bay lock. There is some outside circumstances here, but we'll allow it.
I feel pretty confident about the Dolphins being under.
I'm not going to make a lock, but I'm going to take the under. Minnesota Vikings, a line of 8.5 wins. Can they survive the loss of Sam Darnold?
The one hand, that seems pretty low, but I'm kind of in believe it when I see it mode about JJ McCarthy, so I'll take the under for them.
I mean, six less wins. That's a lot. Where's the money at?
On the over here.
I think still give me the under for the Vikings.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to take the over here. I mean, I get all the reasons, but, yes, they outperformed their point differential last year. Their point differential was still that of a 10 or 11 win team. And, I do think JJ McCarthy can be an adequate quarterback for them. New England Patriots, a line of 8.5 wins.
Eight. Oh yeah, they're one of the teams that Kevin mentioned that has an insanely easy schedule. So I'm sure that is
Yes.
doing a lot of
Second
work there.
easiest in the NFL.
That's still a lot. I don't think I can get there. I like Drake May. I want to succeed. I just don't know if they have what is around him to actually allow him to do that in his second year.
I'm going over for the Patriots.
Wow. Okay. I'm going under as well.
I think the NFC East is basically like the Bills are going to run away with it, but then I think the Patriots are number two. Schedule's terribly easy. I think Drake May has a fine enough season. And Mike Vrabel, I mean, he took some of those Titans teams to more wins than this, did not have a ton of talent.
Okay. New Orleans Saints, a line of 4.5 wins.
4.5 wins. This is like the Browns conversation where it doesn't feel good to go under, but them getting 5 wins would be actually kind of surprising. So I'll take the under.
I am also give this is from a conversation that Kevin and I had. I'm an under, and it was looking up Spencer Rattler's college QBR, where I was like, he wasn't that bad in college, and Spencer Rattler was that bad in college.
But you know
It
who
would be
wasn't?
like if the Seahawks just started Jalen Milroe. He's worse. He is worse than that.
You know who wasn't that bad in college?
Jake Browning.
Jake Haener in this
Oh,
particular
wait, they have
conversation.
Jake Browning too, don't they? Or is it Haener?
Don't think they have Jake Browning, do they?
Okay, Jake Browning's
He's.
still in the Bengals.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
If they had Jake Browning, it's an over. But
Oh, without question. If it's Jake Browning, the line is like 6.5.
I kind of don't get how he hasn't found his way to a team. Like, what are these? He would be so much better. How old is he? 29? Man, if you put Jake Browning on the Saints, it's an over. But
I
I'm
mean,
not betting on
there was
Jake
a minute
Haener.
here I
Sorry.
thought it might be your Seattle Seahawks this year, but alas.
I'm an
Okay.
under. What were you?
I'm an over on this one. 4.5 is just a very low line, and they're in a bad division. That's the thing that
You
differentiates them
hate
from
Clint
Cleveland.
Kubiak.
I mean,
Kevin takes the Saints
they
over every year without fail.
that is true. They had a 6.4 Pythagorean record last year. New York Jets, a line of 5.5 wins.
I'll take the over, given that I took the under on the Patriots and Dolphins, and 5.5 is pretty low. Justin Fields can have good games sometimes,
I
so
think
let's take the over.
the number that I
Wait,
heard
wait.
on.
Wait, wait. This is, I mean, both the Jets and the Giants have 5.5 lines, but this is the Giants first.
Oh, I thought you said Jets.
Let's do it both at the same time.
Okay,
Yeah.
sure.
And all New
Okay.
Jersey. Do you have
I'm
differing
glad we
between them?
clarified this. They both have lines of 5.5.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, let's go over. New York team's over.
Give me an over on both. I
That's
had put a bigger number on the Jets earlier, and I was like, I can't get there. But at 5.5, 6 wins, come on, they could do that.
Yeah, we're making a 3 for 3 on overs for the teams at the Meadowlands. Philadelphia Eagles, a line of 11.5 wins.
They were pretty good last year, as the listener might have heard. They won the Super Bowl. But their defense is really good, and maybe that regressed a little bit. 11.5 is a lot of wins, so I'll take the under.
Give me an over for the Eagles. They're just too complete of a team, basically.
I do think there's probably something about the push sneak that I don't know. I've seen a lot of overs, but we'll find some unders here, I guess, at some point. I'll take an over on them. Pittsburgh, not as many as you have. Pittsburgh, a line of 8.5 wins.
Okay, I said it last year, but this year is going to be the year that Mike Tomlin goes under 500. I will make it a lock this time, though.
I'm in agreement with you. And last year I scoffed at the idea that Mike Tomlin, the person who always goes at least 500 or better. I think the Aaron Rodgers situation is just it's not it. They went into the season with worse quarterbacks than Russell Wilson and Justin Fields, with a worse quarterback than Russell Wilson and Justin Fields.
I'm going under as well. San Francisco 49ers, a line of 10.5 wins.
I think that's reasonable. I think they'll be a lot better. And
Why?
than last year?
Yeah, they lost so much depth defensively.
They
Like,
won six games
for
last
last
year.
year? Okay, then last year, sure. But yeah,
Yeah.
the line is 10 and a half. They have to win 5 more games than last year. 10 and a half, you said, right?
I'm taking the under, but I understand why the over under is where it is. I think they'll still be pretty good.
It's a bonkers over under.
I mean,
And
they
it's a.
also have the easiest schedule in the NFL.
I am aware of that information and it's still wrong. They're favored in Seattle, which I was kind of surprised by.
Oh, I'm not surprised by.
I am an under on the 49ers. It is not a deep team at all. There's basically no defensive depth whatsoever. And all of the people who seem to not like Brock Purdy, all of a sudden are like, well, they've got Brock Purdy. They have no receivers. It's Brock Purdy, it's Christian McCaffrey, it's George Kittle, Trent Williams, and
I need to do some unders. I'm going to take them as an under. Tampa Bay, 9.5.
I think for some reason Vegas always over or sorry, underrates them. We talked about this last year too. This feels low to me given the division they play in, and their offense was good last year. It should continue to be good, even though Chris Godwin is currently injured, so I will take
and
the
Nolan
over.
Cohn. I am gonna do an under 9.5.
Yep.
I am still gonna be under for the Bucks.
Man, the division is it's not great, but I'm gonna take the under here. Tennessee, a line of 5.5 wins.
Wow, that's really low. I wanted to take the under, but and I guess I will, but I don't feel great about it.
I'm also an under. It's
Oh.
rookie quarterback with not much support. He's got
Yeah, the
Tyler
support is a
Lockett.
huge. Yeah.
Give me the over. Washington Commanders, a line of 9.5 wins.
Saved all my unders.
I believe in Jaden Daniels, but I don't really believe in his supporting cast, and I'm still a little bit skeptical about Cliff Kingsbury. They ran extremely hot on fourth downs last year in an extremely unsustainable way. So, as much as I like the team and its kind of new look and want them to succeed, I think there are a lot of ways that they could go under, unfortunately. So I will take the under for them.
I'm also an under on Washington.
I am going to be an under. Yeah, it feels like a little bit of a come back to earth year for Jaden Daniels. I mean, if he has a really good year, then sky's the limit, but that's what it feels like. All right, there we go. We are ready for the 2025 NFL season.
What lock, Ben? Did you have any locks?
Yeah, I said Packers over, which kind of feels like cheating. Let me add the Rams over. That'll make it fun. Rams over
Wow.
9.5 wins.
Okay, there you
That's a
go.
real. I mean, so Jimmy G is still the backup for the Rams. I mean,
Sounds right. Yeah.
I think that matters for what it's worth because penciling in Stafford for a full season is not a great situation, but I do think that Jimmy G can run that offense for what it's worth. Okay.
Ben, before we let you go, did you have any thoughts you wanted to share after listening to our interview with Mike Sean Dugar last week on his book and on the Legion of Boom era?
I thought it was great. Every time Mike is on the podcast, it's always a really good conversation. And I appreciate him because he can listen to all the different sides of the story and present them without necessarily saying that somebody is in the right. Like, I think it's easy to interview somebody and then like come away taking away their point of view. And he's really good at being able to talk to people without necessarily saying like, oh yeah, that person's in the right. So like, he's able to say like both sides are in the wrong here or are fighting for whatever bad reason. So I appreciated that part of his, and also you guys too, when like he presented something that was like talking about the Super Bowl play before the Super Bowl was canceled. Like, yes, there's no reason to run the ball on second down if you only have one timeout left. Like, you have to throw the ball there, and maybe you can quibble about the play call or whatever. But like, the fact that some players are still hung up on not running the ball with Marshawn, even though they had run it the play before and they only had one timeout left. And as Bevel pointed out, I guess, in his interviews with Mike Olshad, they had gotten stuffed so many times in short yard situations by the Patriots in that same game. So why would you expect to be any more successful in that? So I really enjoyed the conversation, even though it did dig up some painful memories.
Yeah, definitely so. All right. Thanks so much for joining us. And we look forward to reconvening at the end of the season to see who was most accurate with our over-unders. Enjoy the season.
Yeah, enjoy the season. Sam Darnold Sunday. Let's go.
Thanks, Ben.